You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 4th of June to the 10th of June 2015. I'm Simon Baker, standing in for the normal presenter Chris Parr, and I'm joined this week by Jack Grove, reporter, Matthew Rice, another writer, and Eddie Bothwell, rankings writer. And we've got various things we're going to talk about this week, obviously, from a very busy week in international higher education with a Going Global conference happening. But we'll probably kick off first with looking at this week's lead story, which will be a story that is coming out the day of this podcast, where HEPI have released their annual survey of students on their academic experience. And then we'll also go on to talk about, with Matthew, extremely interesting piece where he talked to a researcher that basically had travelled to some of the poorest countries in the world looking for small, low-cost private schools, which it might not be your first thought when you come to looking in sort of some of the poorest cities of the world, but we'll hear some more about that a bit later on. And Ellie is going to talk about the aforementioned Going Global conference, which brought up all manner of very interesting discussions. So first, Jack, if I could just turn to you and ask you about this week's main story, which basically this HEPI survey has become a very permanent fixture in the higher education landscape because it throws up some very interesting stats normally about what students see as the quality of the teaching they're getting. But this year we've had a very new question which raises some very interesting points about whether teachers at universities should be qualified.
Yes, that's right. Well, the HEPI survey polls around 15,000 students every year, and it was introduced just after fees were raised to £3,000, and it's tracked students since then. I think it's been going for about 10 years now. And it's asked them a lot about how satisfied they are, but this year they asked them about what they look for in a lecturer. And the finding I found quite interesting was that their top priority for staff was that staff had some form of training, maybe a teaching qualification, rather than the fact that they were active in research in their field. So it raises some quite interesting issues about whether staff should have formal qualifications, whether staff need to be teacher researchers in the very classic Humboldtian sense where good research informs good teaching. And we've got people addressing both sides of the argument saying, yes, research is absolutely crucial for good teaching. Other people saying, actually, you've got lots of great teachers who don't do much research at all, so let people concentrate on teaching and researchers can often do research which they want to do. Also, some other interesting findings are that a very large majority, about 9 in 10 students, are pretty satisfied with their course. But when you ask them a bit more about value for money, that's a completely different picture. In fact, 34% of students in England say they received poor or very poor value for money, and that rose to 44% for those students who had fewer than 10 contact hours a week.
I mean, this survey was kind of jointly issued by the Higher Education Academy, and in the past there have been kind of efforts to make qualifications for university teachers some kind of necessity, or I mean, it was actually put forward in the Brown Review, I think. I seem to remember that all lecturers should have some kind of formal qualification. But what's happened in the past on that? I mean, has that ever become something that could become a reality?
Well, they put it to academics about 3 years ago, and 70% of academics said they didn't want compulsory qualifications. But since then, there's been various moves to encourage lecturers to have it, and at the moment, HESA, which is the body that collects all the statistics for higher education, they ask institutions to say how many of their staff have teaching qualifications. And Nick Hillman, who's the director of HEPI, he says that it would be great if this information could be included in key information sets for students, and they could actually judge institutions on how many of their staff have got qualifications, and that would help inform their choices. And it seems like gradually the sector might be getting there.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite sort of an interesting point in that it's a sort of to-and-fro issue that for various years there's always a suggestion that there should be more teaching qualifications, but it never quite happens. I mean, there are good examples, aren't there, of universities like Huddersfield, I think, where, you know, there's been a drive to make sure that teachers have qualifications, and then, you know, and that's a university that's kind of held in quite high standing, isn't it, in some respect, and had quite close to links to the HEA, I think.
Yeah, they're very proud, Huddersfield, of the work they've done on this, but there's also some people who do question the relevance and the quality of some of the teacher training, and they think it's a bit of a tick box exercise,
sure,
and that
it
doesn't really give you a very good indicator of you know how good teaching is. It's much better, they say, to have a PhD or have a very close interest in a subject. That's a much better, you know, measure of how good and how engaged teachers are with their subject.
Well, it's definitely an issue that's going to continue to rumble on, so have a look at that story. It's on page 6 of this week's issue. Feel free to comment on it on Twitter and under the story, because I'm sure there'll be a long-running debate to be had there on whether there should be some formal qualifications in HE. So moving on now to Matthew and your Outer Limits piece, which is our kind of series about research on the extreme environments or circumstances. And this is a very interesting interview you did this week, I thought, with James Tooley, an academic who seems started life as a socialist, but decided after he'd studied education, sort of philosophy and things, that he was in favour of private education, and he's gone on to research it in some of the poorest parts of the world. If you want to tell us a bit more about that, Matthew.
Yes, I mean, he sort of convinced himself on intellectual grounds that free market solutions were the best solution for education, that basically the state didn't have a necessary role in education at any level at all. It's obviously quite an extreme view, but he sort of thought, well, okay, this may sound all very well in theory, but what happens in practice? So once he was in Hyderabad, he sort of had a day off, and he just sort of set off into one of the slums, and he found that there were a lot of low-cost, very small private schools where even very poor people were willing to pay, you know, a few pence to have their children educated there. I mean, he argues that in a country like India, there's lots of problems with absenteeism of teachers in the state sector and so on. And so he basically got more and more interested in this and more made the case. And, of course, there are a lot of, needless to say, both development experts and, you know, national authorities tend to rather take a dim view of his position. And they, you know, he says that sometimes they concede, OK, well, this may well be true in India, but what if India isn't any longer one of the very poorest countries of the world? Does it apply in other places? So he goes off more and more dangerous, out-of-the-way places. His latest research was in South Sudan and Sierra Leone and Liberia. And basically he just sort of goes into the dodgiest, most dangerous slum and sees what he can find. And he claims you can find these small schools everywhere. And people say, even local people say, aren't you afraid to go into those slums? Yeah. And he says he's never had any problems. But strangely enough, he had a problem recently, a very severe problem, in fact, in Hyderabad, where he was suddenly arrested and thrown into prison. And he's involved in various foundations supporting some of these schools. And he said it was to do with some minor infringement of currency regulations or something, but the issue is obviously whether it was somebody, you know, was out to get him, out to discredit him, because, you know, anyone who's an enemy of state education in effect is bound to attract enemies themselves. So it's about this very extraordinarily kind of adventurous research program he's gone into for, and then this rather horrible episode in India where he was, you know, then in India there's a system whereby people can often be in prison before they come up for trial if they can't afford bail. So he was in there among murderers and gangsters and all sorts.
He was saying that they were helping him out there. If it wasn't for the kindness of these fellow prisoners, that he may have found himself in kind of more dire straits, really, which was quite...
Yes, yeah, he said that they were great, and it was a very moving experience as well as a very traumatic one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating piece, and you know, I definitely encourage people to read it just because of, you know, as a method for research, just to kind of pitch up in these places and say to the taxi driver, take me to the poorest part of town, you know. It was definitely a novel approach to things. So, that's on page 40 this week. So I definitely say it's worth a read. And moving on now to Ellie and the Going Global conference this week, which helpfully for us was in London rather than kind of a long trip away. So we were able to literally go a couple of stops on the tube to cover Going Global this year. And there were lots of interesting sessions. One we picked out for the magazine was one from was some comments by the government's chief scientific advisor, Mark Walport, where he was talking about how academics should actually engage governments in advising on policy. And do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so he spoke about how scientists don't always go about speaking to government policymakers in the best way. He said that scientists are often too concerned with their pet topic, too inward-looking, and not as dispassionate as they should be, was the word he used.
Yeah.
So he sort of pointed out that when government policymakers are sort of deciding what to implement, you know, they look for a range of lenses, and science isn't the only one, and scientists sort of have to bear that in mind.
And I thought kind of the comments that he was making about not mixing values up with science and the example of genetically modified crops or organisms, I think it was the actual GMO is the phrase he used, but that point about, and that you can see there's other areas where this would come into play, but saying that often, you know, emotions or values are kind of mixed up in the argument and that kind of distracts from it was quite interesting.
Yeah, he said, he sort of said it was, you had to make sure that if you're having a discussion about science, it's kept separate from a discussion about values, because, well, the way he put it was just, it stops you having the best discussion.
Yeah.
If you confuse the two.
And, you know, it's different, I suppose, from often from the academic side of things. There's a frustration, I think, that their findings aren't taken on board by government. But he seems to be sort of saying, he's spent time, obviously, in government. He's saying that politicians are looking for this, are looking for different viewpoints, and so not to get too kind of frustrated about that, but yeah, it's an interesting kind of point that he was making. I think
there's so few scientists in Parliament that, and I think one of them has just been voted out. Julian Huppert was one of the few academic scientists in Parliament as MP, so it's quite hard to maybe communicate that sort of scientific way of thinking to people who are generally, you know, lawyers. Management consultants, PR people, before they come into the House of Commons.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things he said was, he said, you know, for that reason, I think, you know, he said quite often scientists say politicians need more education in science, but he kind of wanted to make sure scientists realise that they maybe need more education in politics as well.
Indeed.
That wasn't the only thing at Going Global, obviously. There's some interesting stories we heard from David Willetts. He seemed to have had a regret about the student loan system, and it wasn't that they'd set it up at all or that they'd increased fees to 9K. It was that they should have been offering them more to more students, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, he said that he thought that British students who wanted to study abroad should be able to use their student loans for that.
Okay, right.
It was very interesting. He sort of said that it was something he tried to push through as minister and didn't manage it, and that was one of his main regrets. He did mention the travelling and tuition fees, but not as a regret at all. He said that rather that he thought that fears around the rise in fees were misplaced and that they've now been widely accepted. But judging from comments on Twitter, I'm not sure if everyone would agree with that in the industry.
Not a totally contentious view, perhaps.
Well, you can read more about that David Willetts story on our website, because we did that as an online story, as well as some comments that the new Oxford, or the set-to-be Oxford VC, Louise Richardson, made about radicalisation and education, which were quite interesting. So do go to our website to find out more about that. Plenty more in a news section this week. We've got this very internationalisation news section this week. We've got lots of stories about the visa crackdown on overseas students last year following the discovery of some fraudulent tests, the actual numbers that ended up affecting. And we're talking about almost 20,000 students who are affected, so some quite interesting figures there. And also our main cover feature this week as well, worth a look. is actually an anonymous penned article is the main section of it, from somebody living day to day on kind of temporary teaching contracts and what that's actually like living on in that kind of environment where you're not being paid quite as much as a salaried academic, and also at the same time expected to kind of prepare lessons in less time as you do things like a PhD. So that's well worth looking at as well. That's all for this week. If you want to comment on any of our stories, the comment section is on our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. And as usual, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and all the usual places. And until next week's issue review, thanks for listening.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.